So again, I welcome all of us, including myself, to this new location. Beautiful, comfortable, nice lighting, cool temperature, air conditioned. We can all go to sleep. Or we can stay awake, which is really what the point of all this is. And tonight I'm talking about a topic that is very important to me, and I don't think it's very well presented in any tradition. There aren't very many people who sort of draw the distinctions that I'm trying to make in this particular talk, and that is really the way the mind, the mental framework that we have, the brain, tries to organize its life to include just about everything it can, it structurally, including the heart within it. So because it can't access the heart, which I'll get to the reasons I get to later, it impersonates the heart and does a very good job that convinces us for a long period of time. And the point of this talk is to differentiate between those two different spheres of influence. And the mind we're pretty familiar with, I think, although we don't really recognize the hold or strength it has on us. We just consider it to be sort of the way our life is, the way life is in general, and many of us have not studied it sufficiently to be able to really understand how it distorts our perception and creates a sense of inclusivity or exclusivity and differentiation. It's what it's meant to do. As I am going to be unfolding this particular lecture, I want to show how meditation can either come from the mind or can come from the heart. And that by examining the energies of each and the strategies of each, we can gently release our tendency, our conditioning, from the usual mental way that we frame life and begin to gently relax and open to the other side of life, which is the heart side. So how does the mind do that? Because if you look at the heart is what we all have in common. And I don't mean our humanity, I mean more basic than that. What is true to all of us. What lives within all of us. Which is the equivalence of all of us. And to contrast that, the mind is what differentiates. It what separates out and makes distinctions about. Now, when you start separating out something that is intrinsically whole, you get chaos, right? Because you created things that, in their basic, in their natural state, are not things, including the thing of me. And so you get things rubbing up against other things, and me rubbing up against other designated individuals. And so what the mind's purpose is, once it's create that differentiation, which is very important, I'm not in any way belittling that strength, because it allows us to know about life sufficiently so we can navigate our way through it, so we can find food and not chew on a brick. Right? So that distinction needs to be, once we have taken form, structure, which the mind has created, then we have to navigate through that structure. So the overriding need of what the mind does, has to do, is to create a sense of order within the disorder of its multiple differentiation. So you following this? So it's an ordered machine. It decides, and as I'm speaking about this, each of us get a sense of it operating within us. That this is not life in its organic, original form. That's the heart. This is life as structured by our needs to navigate and travel and procure the necessary food for our table. This is the organ that does that. And so it tries, the mind tries to establish order in every direction it can. Everywhere. It needs an explanation for everything. So it starts out by defining everything. The yous and me's, the this and that's of life. The more it designates something, the more it can rest within the knowledge of its certainty of being that which I designate. And therefore holding that as how I can operate with it or my need of it. But it doesn't stop there. It also tries to order each of us. And it turns on itself. And this is when it really becomes profoundly inefficient. So it doesn't stop asking just the whys of definition externally. It looks at the whys of definition internally so that it can have some sense of who we are, each of us. Never mind the fact that it created the identity of me when it created the objects that it explores and differentiates externally. Those two things arise together. The me of the knowledge of those objects is the same arising as the objects themselves. But it's not satisfied with the order. In fact, it feels very disordered in here. It feels very kind of confused. It's always a little bit troubled, as I'll get to in just a minute. But what it tries to do is it tries to settle things with its own question, with its own way of establishing order. Why am I this way? Why is she looking at me with that odd smile? What? Why? Why is this happening? Why has life taken this turn of events? All of those are questions in which we are attempting to organize, to find definition, distinction within our life. And of course, it can't possibly know the answer to those things, but it pretends to know the answer, often resting upon the emotional validation it gives to the answers. So if it looks at someone and sees that you're frowning, and the first reason I give to someone who's frowning at me stirs my ancient pain of being unlikable, then what I do is designate the fact that you don't like me. I don't have any proof of that. You could be burping up the evening's meal. But that's the way my mind's going to go. And what happens in relationship to that answer is a kind of satisfactory feeling in us that we correctly understood that moment. I know what she was thinking about me. And that sense of self-satisfaction which comes with the explanation, cements what we have interpreted that moment to mean. Has no relationship to facts. It has only relationship to our subjectivity. You see. But we live encased in the need to create order. And so we can't keep asking everybody, what did you smile? What was that smile meant? Because that actually creates more disorder than order. And it creates a kind of dependency and lack of self-assuredness, which is the heart of order. And so we keep thinking our way through problems with the understanding that we know satisfactorily, because we have the emotional equivalent of that, all the answers psychologically that we need. Most of which reinforce the ancient historical traditions of our own pain, because we'll go to the answer when we see somebody frowning. We'll go to the answer that is most easily conditioned in us, and that answer is always the pain body's answer. I know why she doesn't like me, because I don't even like me. How could she like me? So this sense of order is established. And there's also a sense of order in what we do externally. We argue for order. That's the reason we argue, to establish some order, either internal order that I know more than you, or the order of events is how we perceive them. So argument and resistance is a means of, if I let this in, there'll be disorder. So I clamp down, resist it coming in, and therefore I can establish order in my resistance. War is an attempt to establish order. So you can see how far out this particular organ extends itself to establish order. Meanwhile, the heart rests. It doesn't argue. You see? Now, as I'm speaking about the heart, listen to the invitation to move your life in this direction and the invitation to practice in alignment with this particular paradigm. See, it doesn't argue. It sees. Awareness sees, but argues with nothing. And that's its strength. You'd say, well, if it argued, you know, I could then take the side of, well, that would just be more order and disorder. And that's not the organ of choice. You begin to hear how the different energetically, the difference in the energies of the language of the heart, and the energetic space of the heart, as opposed to the language of the mind, and the energy, the driven energy of the mind. Because order, mentally, is never settled. There's always other pieces that need to be extended into to establish more order. I mean, this place has to be kept up. I think the word is entropy. In science, I can't remember if it's high entropy or low entropy, but the world, if left alone, falls into chaos, which may be high entropy. So we start with consolidated order, and if left alone, it becomes disorderly. And so we are having to, over time, constantly control the outcomes to keep that natural movement towards disorder from happening. And so we're always on top of things. We're always leaning into life in order to keep it tucked in sufficiently. Right? And it's because it's not. It can't. I mean, we get sick, we die, we get old, we get cross with one another. Incidences come up where we argue constantly. Wars are occurring. It's in a state of entropy. It's falling apart, always. And we keep trying to mentally draw it back into itself so that it has consolidated purpose and intention. But that's not the way of life. The way of life, they say, the word entropy in spiritual speak is impermanence. It means it's falling apart. You see, so that's what we're up against. But we don't know any other organ or any other way to be except try to hold life together, keeping it from falling apart. That's the only tool we've had. It's like if you go to the gym your whole life and practice one muscle, train one muscle. Well, whatever occurs, that's the only response you can give it, is the one muscle that we have trained. And that one muscle that all of us have trained since birth is the brain and its response to order. But that is where the spiritual journey begins. It begins at knowing that what the brain is doing is an impossible task. Not just a noble task that often fails. It's an impossible task that always fails. But that's the only strength we have. It's the only way we've ever learned in life to present ourselves. That constant sense of self-reflected order. How am I doing? What does she think I'm doing? Am I doing? How's my presentation? Let me look at the vanity aspect of order. The cosmetic aspect of order. All of that. Trying to keep entropy from occurring. And again, I don't know if I'm using that word correctly. So you see that there's a definite shift when we're moving our practice into a different realm. You see? That we have to be very careful that the muscle we exercise within our spiritual practice is not the muscled way we have been going through life. Or we will do exactly the same. We will manifest in exactly the same way. The results will be exactly mirrored to the life we already have. Different experiences will arise because you're probing in a different kind of way. But it will stay disorganized. It will stay fractured. It will stay separate. It will stay distant. And it will stay forever falling into disorder. Because it can't last. What does that mean? It means that life is disordered. And so how we approach our spiritual practice is extraordinarily important. Unless what we want out of it is more of the same. So perhaps we want to create order from our spiritual journey. We want to look better. And since we can't do that because we are aging, in terms of our personal appearance, we'll look better in terms of our psychic appearance, spiritual appearance. Or we want to look quieter in ourselves, or we have a whole plethora of different qualities that we want to nurture to remain and maintain an order of ourselves, on top of ourselves, a product that is pleasing. And we can use spiritual practice for that, with that intent and with that purpose. And it will look cosmetic. It will look self-driven. It will look ambitious. It will look like a journey, which is the only way the mind can conceive of life in terms of a journey. Our spiritual life will replicate that journeying profile. How far am I? How close am I? How am I doing? Am I better than I was? Are people noticing me? How am I sitting? So you begin to see that it takes a real level of maturity to want to move out of that. Because, as I said, it's the only muscle we know. It's the only relationship to life most of us have ever had. And so, when I sit down, of course that's what I'm going to try to replicate. And not only that, the practice asks you to have a kind of ambition early on. It encourages a kind of tension and strength in cultivation, just so that you can get to the point that you can let it go. It doesn't work for very many people. For me to just pronounce the difference between the mind and the heart and say, go with the heart. Because you would go with the heart ambitiously. Anyone hearing that would then say, okay, how do I get that? You hear the Dharma and you say, how do I get the Dharma? How do I get it? You make it into a journey and that's fine, because that's the way we frame everything. We have to learn our way out of the old mechanism, out of the old paradigm into the new. And the way we do that, well, one way is that we meet in group and we hear how other people are doing it. It's an extraordinarily powerful way to meet, Sangha. The other way we do it is that we begin to see internally how this working in this fashion, because now we're very up close and personal with ourselves. When we start practice, we have changed our scope of perception to be, you know, the city or the world or whatever it is, into a kind of introspection. And so we get very personal with the pain that we are producing, or the tension or resistance that we are creating internally. And as we begin to see that many of the strategies we've used in our whole life are creating that pain, we back up for a second and said, wait a second. I remember a talk in August of 2014 when he said, be careful of this. And we might wake up to the fact that this very sense of resistance and internal ambition is creating the forces of my own discomfort. That's the kind of feedback you absolutely need to journey forward. And even though every cell in our body says, keep doing what you've always done, keep reaching forward, trying hard, getting somewhere you're not, looking how well you're doing, slowly we sense the tension that are associated with that form of a journey. And we get tired of creating pain for ourselves. And we say, enough, enough. And then the spiritual journey moves from differentiation to what we have in common. Okay? Now, we don't know what we have in common. I mean, we start with our humanity. Okay, we're all human beings. That leaves a lot of life out, by the way. But it's a common denominator for those who are of our species. And so I'm going to work on my prejudice, and I'm going to work on this, and I'm going to be friendly, and I'm not going to... And my heart, my metta, you know, and all of that, and that's good. But our definitions are very limited. And it's still kind of mind-driven because we keep checking to see how well we're doing in relationship to it. So we haven't really escaped the power of the mind. We've just changed the direction the mind is going towards personal self-centeredness to a more universal inclusion of our species. But the direction is moving, and that's good. So now I'm going to take you back in history about 4 billion years. To that moment when the one-celled living protozoa or bacteria or whatever it was, that life that first sprang forth once on this earth, not multiple times, but once. Why? How do I know that? Because of the genetic familiarity of all living things, including vegetation. Grass has 50% of the DNA of human beings. We all have a common ancestry, all the way back to a single, once ignited form of life. At that moment, before it split, it was singular and whole. And then the forces of the environment pressured it so that it began to adapt to the environment once it split. But what didn't split was the common denominator of the heart that it shared within that first division of the cell into two cells. What did change was the structural way that particular organism grew and adapted to the environment. And now, many trillions upon trillions of divisions later, we rest upon the structural differences, not the common denominator of the heart. And what we are attempting to do here in all spiritual journeys, authentic spiritual journey, is to release the dependency on the structure, which is mind-created, the adaptive structural form of life, and rest it upon that which has never changed, could not change, is inalterably one with all of life. And now suddenly we get a sense of not being inclusive to just human beings, but to the whole spectrum of all structures. So what does a practice look like? And how does the mind distort those qualities of heart that are very near and very precious? Very near. very near when we're not focused upon the structural differences, the differentiation. And that's what all of Buddhism is meant to do, is meant to extract our investment in the structural differences. And then there's only, that's the numerator. And then there's the common denominator from which we fall into once we haven't leaned ourselves outside of that realm. And as we begin to practice, you can hear the words of the practice encouraging not the leaning into further structures, but the rest and relaxation within the structure we're in. And when we rest and we don't have the tension of the need to try to control it, to try to organize it and order it, make it orderly, we fall immediately into the common denominator. There's only two places you can go. It's one whole, just like a fraction. And the common denominator is always there, always available to catch us if we let go of the need to orderly, to have life orderly. Because it's not and cannot be. And that has to... I mean, we are trying to surmount eons of conditioning that says we do have control over the orders of life, the orderliness of life. And so the reflex is to clamp your fist and try harder. I understand that. Believe me, I understand that. But where is this? You see, where is the common denominator? I don't have to search for it, or it wouldn't be common. I don't have to try and be ambitious with it, or I'll be reinvesting in my need to order life. This has to be in the midst of disarray. This has to be in the midst of everything. This has to be so accessible that you have to look away from it in order not to see it. That's what's so amazing. And the way we look away from it in order not to see it is to move towards more order. Is to try to get it all, you know, in proper alignment. To try to balance my seven factors. And so much of what we teach in spiritual lingo and language and tradition is how to organize yourself to become spiritual. And it's missing the point, and that's why I say that you have to come upon this, because not only are you up against your own eons of conditioning, you're up against a spiritual tradition that has held a particular perspective that is not spot on. You have to find your way through the inaccuracies as well as the alignments. You have to be completely alone in this thing. You have to look at each thing and see it and reference it in terms of the direction, the view that you feel you want to move. If you want to move towards less suffering, which is the view the Buddha is encouraging, then you have to line up your entire journey to that. You can't let the authority of any teacher or any text be more important than your self-learning. And so I thought it would be fun to just look at some of the ways the mind impersonates the heart to make it seem as if you're moving forward in a spiritual direction. Because they're very clever. Yeah, they should be clever, right? The difference between compassion, which is letting down the guard of your heart so that you feel the vulnerability of the disarray. That's what compassion is. There's no story that drives compassion. There's the disarray of life, the pain and the suffering of life. That, as opposed to the mental impersonation of that, the forgery of that, which is pity. Now I am ordered and I'm looking at somebody who's disordered. And I'll try to help them come into their own sense of orderliness from my stability. Okay? So from your insanity, you're trying to impart sanity. And that's how the mind works. And it feels really good. And I helped her today, you know? I got her a loaf of bread. She was hungry. I'm not denying the importance of that. I'm just saying that it's not complete. Compassion is a complete response, a disorderly response, an unstructured response. So let's move to another one. This one, equanimity as opposed to indifference. None of us, we think the way out of our pain is by not feeling. And so when we hear the word balance or equanimity, we sense that that can happen by not feeling. And so, even some of the most experienced among us fall into that trap, thinking that we should be like a flat EEG, have no brain wave whatsoever. Well, he must really be quiet. His brain waves are flat. No, a corpse has... I don't ever even use equanimity. I think it's a terrible word. Because you find equanimity. It discovers you. It is not a goal, a reachable goal, an organized goal. It's when the heart has released any resistance to life and shows up, because awareness shows up, but it shows up without dispute, because it has been drained of dispute. It sees that any dispute is an attempt to organize something which is intrinsically unorganizable. And when that happens, you recognize for the first time what equanimity is. And that it's not some skill or cultivated way I perceive life from kind of a distant or an indifferent way. Love to a feeling tone. love, which is just the state of being. But I have to prove I have love, so I'm waiting for a feeling tone or something to come up, maybe romance or something. And that proves that I am capable of loving. That has organized my life so that now I have this in it as well. I'll tell you a story. A friend of mine said to me many years ago, I've never felt love. Never had it, never had it. Never felt it. Never really want to feel. And then a friend of his was going away, and he asked him if he would take care of his cat for a couple of weeks while he was traveling. So he was feeding the cat very mechanically, I'm sure. And one day he sits down with the cat and he starts to pet it. And there's a sense of sensitivity and preciousness of the moment and aliveness and just the warm-heartedness. And he realized that was the first time he had ever felt that. I love these because they nail us. I like to be nailed. Here's one. Patience. Okay, what does it mean to be patient, you see? The mind's interpretation of patience is waiting. Okay, just going to sit on my hands. But patience has no sense of time whatsoever. It doesn't say, God, it's been 12 minutes. It doesn't say that. Patience is open and inclusive. It simply is there until whatever the next event arises meets it. And there's no hostility, no built-in resentment. This is the heart. The waiting is the mind. The waiting says, how long have I been waiting? And I will smother my resentment as long as she's out here in 5 minutes. Then that's asking too much of me. But it's a very close facsimile. Waiting. Okay, I'm being patient, you know. How am I doing? I'm doing pretty well, you know. I'll read another magazine. Damn. You know, I could be, no, I'm being patient. You know, it's like that. Here's one. Sincerity, which is heartfelt. Were you just connected, interested, sincerely there, not there for any other? And then there's seriousness. I'm serious. Well, that's good. You can be serious, but there may not be any sincerity within that at all. But it looks good. I'm serious meditator, walking, sitting. And somebody else is like, oh, this is so hard. God Almighty, oh, gosh. That's the sincerity. The ownership, the willingness to accommodate, the looking at it, the seeing it, the presence of it. See, we're not talking about anything but presence. How do we access presence? How do we access the common denominator? You look for it in a different way than you were looking for order in your life. We have to look at it from a different vantage point, from a different perception. That old mental frame of reference has to be released. And then we sense it. Then it comes in. Oh, God, where have I been? This is so obvious. Okay, thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two? You see, as you sit, I had a whole another hour that I could have gone on and on here. But listen to some of the instructions that we impart. They're instructions of the heart. Good instruction should always be instructions of the heart. Relax. Release yourself from the thought, because thought is an organizing principle of how the mind works. Sense the awareness that's here. Add nothing to this experience. Don't try to organize the experience. Don't try to control it. Release the mental need to do that. Just presence with whatever is occurring. Just awareness. And it will find you. Once we have released our need to orderly, to have an orderly presentation. It's moving. Life is moving on its own. I don't know how it's moving. It's just moving. Let's let it move. Our job is to be present within that movement. That's all. Okay. Thank you all very much. So if you have any questions or comments you'd like to present, I will do my best. Yes, yes.
How would you get to the right heart instead of from control to the heart?
Right.
Control to despair, and how do you get there?
Right, no, I got No, it's a beautiful question. The question has to do with when you start releasing control and start being willing to feel the sort of the chaos of life. What keeps you from falling into despair? What's the next thing is despair. You know, you despair. You get so that it's, you just can't live with that. You know, it just feels like it's against everything you've ever wanted in your life. So this is a very important intermediate step, is that what we're also doing is finding that heart response to our emotional life that doesn't try to change the emotional life but doesn't buy into the story of it in the same way. So when we're on the right track and we feel a sense of despair, which happens because you're changing paradigms before you have landed in the one you're going to, you're out of the one you used to be in. And so there's a kind of awkwardness in that space between those two. And oftentimes despair or discouragement comes in. And so the best way to move with that is to move with it from the paradigm you're going into rather than the paradigm you've come from. The paradigm you've come from, which is the mind's paradigm, then makes assertions about the despair that concludes from the despair and tries to make a life organized despairingly. Okay? So that doesn't work. Where you're moving into is the presence of despair, but without configurating it in any ordered way whatsoever. So, okay, I feel it, but I'm not going to add the need to have to think my way into why I'm despairing, what I'm going to do about my despair, well, who I'm going to talk to, what I'm going to say, you know, it's going to be a life of this, and oh my God, I'll be forever. That's looking at it from the paradigm of the brain. A paradigm of awareness feels it and is very alive to it. That was a key sentence there. We're not turning away from it. And because we're not forming a new scenario from it, it really dissipates quite quickly. Because it's nature is disorganization. Nature is that it's going to move away. It's going to end. It's going to move out of despair into whatever the next thing is. So wherever you land, and this is really key to the instructions we offer, especially emotions, because emotions have the tendency, are the awakening place, mind, the mental awakening place for most of us that gets our attention. Oh my God, I'm feeling that depression of long ago. I'm feeling that, well, whatever it is, that we just are quiet with them. The surest way to the paradigm of evolution that we're moving to is being quiet with something. The surest way to go back into the brain's organized principle is to be noisy about something and to think ourselves back into that. So I'm just going to be quiet with it. And you have to be very careful because there's another level up that says, God, yes, but I'm really worried that this is going to stay with me. No, that's not being quiet. Being quiet is being quiet. And you'll really see the entropy of it. It doesn't last. And after a number of occasions where that is confirmed, then there'll come a point where you'll see that you want to kind of milk the depression a little bit because it's so familiar and your whole life has been tied to it, and you know you've gotten a lot of sympathy when you were depressed, and it comes up and you go, should I go that way? And sudden something in you simply can't take that step and make it continue. I remember right where I was when that happened. And there I was. I said, damn, that's gone away. I can't do it anymore. I can't even try to do it anymore. And it's simply by knowing the nature of the mind with such completion that you realize that your choice is to be in pain or not, and that the heart at some point won't let you move in the direction of pain. It just won't, because it doesn't make any sense to, even from a mental perspective, it no longer makes sense to do that. Okay, all. Thank you.